The History of Protestantism, Volume 2, Book 14th, Chapter 2, Genevese Martyrs of Liberty. Before the day of Geneva's greatness should have arrived, many of its heroic defenders would be resting in the grave, the road thither for nearly all of them being by the scaffold. Let us recount the fate of the more prominent, and first of all, of Berthelier. One morning, as he was going to breathe the fresh air outside the walls in his favorite meadow, bathed by the waters of the Rhone, he was arrested by the Duke's soldiers. He bore himself with calmness and dignity both at his arrest and during the few days now left him of life. He wrote on the walls of his prison a verse of scripture, which permits us to hope that he had cast anchor in another world than that which he was so soon to leave. His head fell by the hand of the executioner at the foot of Caesar's Tower, in the aisle in the Leman, near the point where the Rhone issues from the lake. His fellow citizens beheld him die, but could not save him. The cruel deed but deepened their purpose of vengeance. The head of the patriot was fastened up on the bridge of the Arve. Blackening in the sun, it was a ghastly memorial of Savoyard tyranny, and a thrilling appeal to the compatriots of Berthelier never to submit to the despot who had no other rewards than this for the noblest of Geneva's sons. The fate of Bonivar was less tragic, but has become better known to us from the notice bestowed upon him by a great poet. He was deprived of his priory, and while a scaffold was set up for Berthelier at one extremity of the Leman, a dungeon was found for Bonivar at the other. The modern tourist, as he passes along the lovely shores of the lake, beneath the magnificent amphitheater of mountains that overhang Vevey, has his attention arrested by the massy and still entire walls of a castle, surrounded on all sides by the deep waters of the Leman, save where a drawbridge joins it to the shore. This is the castle of Chillon, the scene of Bonivar's imprisonment, and where the track worn by his feet in the rocky floor may still be traced, while the ripple of the water, which rises to the level of the loophole in the wall, may be heard when the wind stirs upon the lake. At this stage of the drama, the wretched man who had filled the office of bishop and had been the Duke's co-conspirator in these attempts upon the liberty of Geneva died miserably at Pignerol, on the southern side of the Alps, on the very frontier of the territory of the Waldenses. His dying scene was awful and horrible. Around his bed stood only hirelings. Careless of the agonies he was enduring, their eyes roamed round the room in quest of valuables, which they might carry off whenever his breath should depart. The effigies of his victims seemed traced upon the wall of his chamber. They presented to him a crucifix. He thought it was Berthelier and shrieked out. They brought him the last sacrament. He fancied they were sprinkling him with blood. His lips, whitened with foam, let fall execrations and blasphemies. Such is the picture which a Romanist writer draws of his last hours. But before the dark scene closed, something like a ray of light broke in. He conjured his coadjutor and successor, Pierre de la Baume, not to walk in his footsteps, but to defend the franchises of Geneva. He saw in the sufferings he was enduring the punishment of his misdeeds. He implored forgiveness and hoped God would pardon him in purgatory. But Charles III, Duke of Savoy and Piedmont, still lived, and unwarned by the miserable end of his accomplice, he continued to prosecute his guilty project. Another martyr of liberty was now to offer up his life. The man who most embarrassed the Duke still lived. He must be swept from his path. Charles did not believe in patriotism and thought to buy Levrier. The judge spurned the bribe. Well, the axe will do what gold cannot. He was arrested at the gates of Saint-Pierre, as he was leaving after hearing morning mass. He wore a long camlet robe, probably his judicial gown, and a beautiful velvet cassock. Mounted hastily upon a wretched nag, his hands tied behind his back, and his feet fastened below the belly of his horse, the judge was carried, in the midst of armed men, who jeered at and called him traitor, to the castle of Bonn, where the duke was then residing. The castle of Bonn, now a ruin, is some 2 leagues from Geneva. It stands in the midst of scenery such as Switzerland only can show. The panorama presents to the eye an assemblage of valleys, with their carpet-like covering, foaming torrents, the black mouths of gorges, pines massed upon the hilltops, and beyond, afar off, the magnificence of snowy peaks. The tragedy enacted in this spot we shall leave D'Aubigné to tell, who has here, with his usual graphic power, set in the light of day a deed that was done literally in the darkness. Shortly, says the historian, after Bellegarde's, the man who pronounced doom, departure, the confessor entered, discharged his duty mechanically, uttered the sentence, ego te absolvo, and withdrew, showing no more sympathy for his victim than the provost had done. Then appeared a man with a cord. It was the executioner. It was then 10 o'clock at night. The inhabitants of the little town and of the adjacent country were sleeping soundly, and no one dreamt of the cruel deed that was about to cut short the life of a man who might have shone in the first rank in a great monarchy. The headsman bound the noble Lévrier, armed men surrounded him, and the martyr of law was conducted slowly to the castle yard. All nature was dumb. Nothing broke the silence of that funeral procession. Charles's agents moved like shadows beneath the ancient walls of the castle. The moon, which had not reached its first quarter, was near setting, and shed only a feeble gleam. It was too dark to distinguish the beautiful mountains, in the midst of which stood the towers whence they had dragged their victim. The trees and houses of Bonn were scarcely visible. One or two torches, carried by the provost's men, alone threw light upon this cruel scene. On reaching the middle of the castle yard, the headsman stopped, and the victim also. The ducal satellites silently formed a circle round them, and the executioner prepared to discharge his office. Lévrier was calm. The peace of a good conscience supported him in this dread hour. Alone in the night, in those sublime regions of the Alps, surrounded by the barbarous figures of the Savoyard mercenaries, standing in that feudal courtyard which the torches illumined with a sinister glare, the heroic champion of the law raised his eyes to heaven and said, "By God's grace, I die without anxiety for the liberty of my country and the authority of Saint Peter." The grace of God, liberty, authority, these main principles of the greatness of nations were his last confession. The words had hardly been uttered when the executioner swung round his sword and the head of the citizen rolled in the castle yard. Immediately, as if struck with fear, the murderers respectfully gathered up his remains and placed them in a coffin. And his body was laid in earth in the parish church of Bonn, with the head separate. At that moment the moon set, and black darkness hid the stains of blood which Lévrier had left on the courtyard. Charles of Savoy did not reflect that the victories of brute force, such as those he was now winning, but paved the way for moral triumphs. With every head that fell by his executioners, he deemed himself a stage nearer to the success he panted to attain. Some illustrious heads had already fallen, so many more, say 20, or it might be 30, and he would be Lord of Geneva. The small but much coveted principality would be part of Savoy, and the object so intently pursued by himself and his ancestors for long years would be realized. The Duke was but practicing a deception upon himself. Every head he cut off dug more deeply the gulf which divided him from the sovereignty of Geneva. Every drop of blood he spilt but strengthened the resolution in the hearts of the patriots that never should the Duke call them his subjects. They never fail who die in a great cause. The block may soak their gore. Their heads may sodden in the sun. Their limbs be strung to city gates and castle walls. But still their spirit walks abroad. Though years elapse, and others share as dark a doom, they but augment the deep and sweeping thoughts which overpower all others, and conduct the world at last to freedom. Nevertheless, what with stratagem this hour and violence the next, treachery within Geneva and soldiers and cannon outside of it, it did seem as if the Duke were making way, and the proud little city must, by and by, lay its independence at his feet. In fact, for a moment, Geneva did succumb. On the 15th of September, 1525, the Duke surprised the city with a numerous host. The patriots had nothing left them but massacre or speedy flight. Fleeing through woods or mountainous defiles, pursued by Savoyard archers, some escaped to Bern, others to Freiburg. The Duke, having entered the city, summoned a council of such citizens as were still to be found in it, and with the axes of his halberdiers suspended over their heads, these spiritless and lukewarm men promised to accept him as their prince. But the vow of allegiance given in the Council of Halberds today was revoked on the morrow. The Duke was at first stunned, and next he was terrified, at this sudden revival of opposition, when he believed it had been trampled out. Influenced by this mysterious fear, he hastily left Geneva, never again to enter it, and let fall, after having seemingly secured it, what he and his ancestors had been struggling for generations to grasp. The Duke had but scattered the fire, not extinguished it. The parts of Switzerland to which the patriots had fled were precisely those where the light of the Reformation was breaking. At Bern and Freiburg, the exiles of Geneva had an opportunity of studying higher models of freedom than any they had aforetime come in contact with. They had been sent to school, and their hearts, softened by adversity, were peculiarly open to the higher teaching now addressed to them. How often in after years was the same thing repeated which we see realized in the case of these early champions of freedom? Were not the patriotic citizens of Spain and Italy again and again chased to the British shores? And for what end? That there they might study purer models, be instructed in deeper and sounder principles, have their views of liberty rectified and enlarged, and on their return to their own country might temper their zeal with patience, fortify their courage with wisdom, and so speed the better in their efforts for the emancipation of their fellow subjects. Fruitful indeed were the months which the Genevese exiles spent abroad. When they returned in February 1526, after the flight of the Duke, a new era returned with them. Their sufferings had elicited the sympathy, and their characters had won the admiration of the noblest among the citizens of the states where they had been sojourning. They recognized the important bearing upon Swiss liberty of the struggle which Geneva had maintained. It was the extreme citadel of the Swiss territory towards the south. It barred the invaders' road from the Alps, and it was impossible to withhold from the little town the meed of praise for the chivalry and devotion with which, single-handed, it had taken its stand at this Swiss Thermopylae and held it at all hazards. But it was not right, they felt, to leave this city longer in its isolation. For their own sakes, as well as for Geneva's, they must extend the hand of friendship to it. An alliance offensive and defensive was formed between the three governments of Bern, Freiburg, and Geneva. If the conflicts of the latter city were not yet ended, it no longer stood alone. By its side were now two powerful allies. Whoso touched its independence touched theirs. If the gospel had not yet entered Geneva, its gates stood open towards that quarter of the sky which the rising sun of the Reformation was flooding with his beams.